Maybe the only guy I've ever met who's got the cojones to say, hey, maybe these are not friendly beings at all. Here is Dr. David Jacobs. Dr. Jacobs, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Art, and welcome back to you.
And have somebody of your stature, and then I push up the other button here, and Bud Hopkins, I think. Bud, hey.
Hi there. How are you, Art? And Dave.
So here we are with two of the world's best people looking into abduction. So I've got, a million questions. Congratulations on your new book coming out called Sight Unseen, Bud.
Well, thank you very much.
Tell me something about it real quick.
Okay, well, this is a book where I look into issues of UFO invisibility, of the fact that when abductions take place, the craft, the abductees, and the aliens are all somehow unseeable.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that we've known for a long, long time, but it's the first time it's been gone into systematically. And the other part of the book has to do with the seen part, which is the fact that there are, seem to be transgenic beings, quote-unquote hybrid beings, part human, part alien, who seem to be operating in a daily way on our planet, driving cars, shopping, living, and so forth. But the rest of the book has to do with science that is going on our Earth, which makes these things seem plausible rather than sort of crazy.
So you're different... suggesting these beings are living among us now.
Well,
that was one of the first things on Dr. Jacobs' list, that our question, are the hybrids living among us now? What brings you two to these conclusions? I presume you agree, Dr. Jacobs.
Well, I think that Bud has more information about it than I do. I know that they can certainly be here for periods of time, but Bud has investigated them over extended periods of time, I think.
But nevertheless, you would seem to be leaning toward thinking they are among us.
Well, I think that they are in especially in related to the abduction phenomenon.
Huh. I suppose to conduct a successful abduction, one has to know something about the target, right?
Well, yes, and of course, people are abducted throughout the course of their lives, so from infancy on, as Bud actually first discovered many years ago. And so therefore, when hybrids deal with them, they deal with them for long periods of time.
A hybrid, let's define a hybrid. When you two say hybrids, what do you mean? Either one of you.
Bud, why don't you take that?
Well, in one case, for instance, that I go into, we have a man who looks very human in this particular case. When you may mean hybrid or transgenic being, as if there's been some genes moved from one species to another. What you're really dealing with is a being that may pass totally as a human. Mm. In one of the cases, as I mentioned, the man seemed to be a man in his 50s, able to drive a car, speak normally, and so forth, and yet actually led this young woman to an abduction, drove her, as it were, into a field in New Jersey where the UFO met. And this hybrid being was able to read her mind, control her, very much like the gray aliens do, control her actions, and actually then bring her right to the aliens for an abduction. And yet he looked as if he were a man in his 50s who even wore glasses and drove a car. So we have this very, very strange mix of very human features.
I guess I'm asking, are these hybrids genetic mixtures of aliens and humans? Is that what's been going on in some of them?
Yes, I don't think there's any doubt that that's the way to define it. Yeah.
Is there any way at all, either one of you, to recognize these hybrids? Are there any differences from the normal human at all that would make you turn around and look again?
Well, I think, for my part, that when you're talking about hybridization, you're talking actually about a spectrum of beings. Some look quite human, some look quite alien, most look in the middle. The ones I think that can deal with this on Earth for extended periods of time are what I call late-stage hybrids, and that is to say they really look human, and you would not be able to tell the difference unless you were looking in for specific anatomical differences in a ways that you wouldn't just do casually.
Were either one of you able to hear my gray alien description and analysis done by Bill Hamilton prior to this hour?
No, I wasn't.
No, you weren't. All right. I'm going to give you a few of these things very quickly, both of you, and see if you agree with them. Mm-hmm. This is by Bill Hamilton. Inference is drawn by the appearance of a gray. The head is large by human standards. Inference, more brain capacity. Eyes are generally slanted, large and black. Inference, eyes probably gather more light than humans. Infers dimmer sun and thinner atmosphere. Nose is usually vague, too small, narrow, is visible. Inference, thinner atmosphere. Mouth is indicated by a small slit without lips. The mouth appears to be non-functional. Inference, the atmosphere may not support sounds very well. Natural selection may have given gray EB small mouth and ears. No teeth. Inference, does not masticate food for a source of nutrients. The body and head are completely hairless. Inference, hairless bodies may indicate warmth, even though the air is thin, could be warm because planet is close to sun, or grays do not live above ground. And it goes on and on. Does that sound, do you think it's fair to draw inferences based upon the general description of the grays?
Yeah, Bud, why don't you take that first?
Well, the descriptions are certainly accurate. That's the kind of description we get over and over and over again, have for decades. Whether or not the inferences as to what they imply are accurate or not is another story. There are certainly logical inferences that a person could make,
yes,
but they're not necessarily accurate. We don't really know.
Right.
Right. I agree with that. And I did the same thing actually in the threat, and I've written articles. I'm sorry, in Secret Life I did the same thing. I inferred from their gross morphology, how they might eat or get fuel and whether they breathe air and that sort of stuff. And I did the same thing in the threat with more information. And I do think that that's a legitimate thing to do, and I'm glad that people are doing it, to tell you the truth, because it's time to begin to deal with the data that's already on hand. We've collected a tremendous amount of information, as have other researchers, and we've been putting out the information semi-regularly anyway, and we have to start taking stock of exactly what we have, and so I think that Hamilton is certainly on the right mental track.
All right, hybrids. If they're living among us now, any inference that we can draw about their presence with regard to motive? Either one of you have any idea why they would be living among us?
But once again,
in one of the cases I deal with in Sight Unseen. There seems to be a kind of nurturing of a human abductee over a long period of time, a man who lived, an apparent hybrid, who lived with a family, and in a sense it would certainly seem that was negotiating the abduction of that child with the abductees and taking the child to an abduction site and so forth. And there seems to be a kind of studying of the behavior of human beings, too, which they seem to be trying to learn by getting very, very close to the texture of real life. But again, some of these things are hard to ascertain, but it seems to be definitely going on.
We are now several years down line from when I first interviewed both of you, and so many, many abductions have now occurred. Do either one of you have any doubts about the phenomena itself?
Everybody has doubts. You can't be human and not have doubts, but I think that the evidence is not just compelling, it's overwhelming. And to begin to deny the evidence puts you into a very, very bizarre mental realm, because the evidence keeps piling up. It keeps accruing. It gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And denial of the import of this evidence in light of the fact that there is no psychological model for it, makes one kind of crazy, actually. so you just have to go where the evidence leads you, and it leads you to one place, I think.
You know, Art, I've been asked about that same question a number of times, and I realized that it's with some regret that I realize that I no longer have the luxury of disbelief about
right.
this. It's
right.
such a difficult thing to accept. It's so crazy, and it's so outside what we want to be true, and the realm of the possible as we've always imagined. It's outside that, and so to have to accept it is somehow a disadvantage.
I really do actually agree with that. Prior to the hour, I said, you know, the bar has been kind of passed on the fact that it's occurring for me. That bar is past, and I'm up to asking and really wanting to know why and what this is all about. So that one bar is past for me. It does seem to be happening. So I guess I'm sold on that one. The next obvious question is, what's happening to us? Why are they doing it? And hybrids would be a good place to start. I mean, why produce half-human, half-alien beings? And what purpose would they serve here on Earth? Would they assist in continuing or fostering new abductions or what?
But once again, you
well, I think, Dave, I think that's so much the subject of both your books that it's really a thing. Dave is, I just have to say, I'd take my hat off to Dave for the courage that he's shown in following the evidence through to a logical conclusion.
Hey, look, back during the days when we were getting the little warm and fuzzy E.T., Dave was the only guy stepping forward saying, hey, one moment, please. But perhaps so, but these may not be friends of ours, and everybody ought to just sort of slow up here a little bit. And I found that pretty brave at the time.
Well, or foolhardy, one of the two. But but the fact is that I wish I could get evidence of touchy-feely benevolent beings. That would make my life a lot easier. I'll tell you that. And I could sleep a lot easier at night too. But in fact, I just don't get that, and I never have, to tell you the truth, not in the way that other people do anyway, and so my evidence has been very, very strictly controlled. That is to say, I'm extremely careful in how I gather my evidence, and I'm very careful in my questioning, and I'm very conservative, and I don't accept at face value what people say automatically, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always waiting for verification from others. And I've managed to get some controls together so that when people do tell me what's going on with them, I can have a certain amount of assurance that they're on the right track and that there's a certain amount of believability in them. Now, having said that, the question is, you know, what's the deal with hybrids?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Bud, I remember, but if I may talk about you in the third person, even though you're right there, you called me up in 1984, I think it was, or maybe it was 85, and you told me you had this most amazing case that you'd ever heard, how this woman was abducted and they showed her a bizarre looking baby. And the baby sort of looked half human and half alien, and they wanted her to feed the baby, put the baby up to her breast. And I remember thinking, I have never heard anything so off the wall and so bizarre in my life. And to even mention the word baby in the context of UFOs and abductions just didn't make any sense whatsoever. And I think that was sort of the beginning, the early parts of your discovery of this reproductive aspect of the abduction phenomenon.
Maybe it would be worthwhile asking Bud to re-relate that story.
Well, actually, that goes back to 1983. It's even earlier. But it's the book that I wrote. Intruders about that particular case. But the point is,
no, this was actually Chris. This was Chris.
Oh, it's Chris before that.
Yeah.
Well, but Debbie was 83 was when I got into that case.
And well, this was the first one, though, I think, that you...
Yeah,
Because I remember that call. That call was the turning point of my life.
It might be true, but what I began to pick up was there were several people who described to me that amongst the abduction experiences that they remembered partially or altogether, there was a strange physical situation where they remember having been pregnant, even though they might not have been sexually active or whatnot, and how they got pregnant. They were definitely pregnant, and they suddenly weren't pregnant anymore. And not getting pregnant, I mean, without any sense of a miscarriage or anything like that, the pregnancy disappearing was really upsetting. And then they told me separately, different people, that they had these very vivid memories of being shown the tiny baby and being told the baby was theirs. And they were being asked to hold the baby, to bond with it, or to take put it to their breast. Even when they weren't lactating, they seemed to be able to lactate and feed the baby. And all of this seemed outrageous. And yet I started getting case after case when I began asking people, asking women if you've ever had any unusual pregnancies. And out came one thing after another, and the idea that the baby was either, it was actually partially human, partially alien in its appearance, that either it was a situation of artificial insemination or an already fertilized ovum was, which had been, let's say, genetically altered, had been inserted in them as if the host of a female womb was essential to the development of this baby. And then it was removed after a period of time, and very often these babies seem to be reared in some kind of tank of liquid. They're not brought to term in anyone's body. Well, the whole thing seemed outrageous, and yet when we look back to the Betty and Barney Hill case, we knew that there was a sperm sample taken from Barney Hill, and that Betty Hill was given what she called a pregnancy test. And, of course, going back even further to the case in, I forget the name, in Brazil.
I tell you what, right at a break, you two. Hold on a sec. We'll be right back. Two of the greats are here, Bud Hopkins, Dr. David Jacobs, from the high desert in the nighttime. When you think about things like this, this is Coast to Coast AM. Once again, Dr. David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins, two of the greats with us, and we were talking about pregnancy, and I was trying to imagine how anybody could get pregnant. I mean, there's usually a 9-month period in there, but you sort of answered that, saying that perhaps these babies were raised, Bud, in some sort of chamber?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So do these hybrids... Do you believe, either one of you, these hybrids know what they are? Are they being instructed? What do they know?
Well, just in terms of some of the material covered in the book, that's a very good question to know exactly what they know about their own origin and physical
right.
makeup. We
right.
don't really know that, but there is some reason to believe that they're a little bit conflicted on that issue as to exactly who or what they are.
Do you have either one of you interviewed anybody who claims to be a hybrid or that you suspect of being a hybrid?
I have not. I've had people call me up and tell me that they think that their roommate is a hybrid, you know. And one time I had a woman call me up who actually was a professor at a major university mm-hmm. and told me her roommate was a hybrid. And she made a really good case, I must say.
In what way? How?
Well, her, she was this very, very strange person and who didn't know certain basic things about normal life and was very, very, it was very odd. But this was just on the phone and I didn't, you know, it was thousands of miles away and I couldn't just go out there and start investigating it. But I've had other people who say that they have seen hybrids, that they have that they have had relationships with hybrids who actually held down jobs and that sort of thing, and mm-hmm. and these people are solid citizens who are not prone to fantasy or to lying, and so you know, there is a situation in which hybrids can kind of live these sort of normal lives, but ultimately, I guess the question is what's the purpose of this? Why are these hybrids, being produced,
yes.
in a sense?
Yes.
And my own research has led to the conclusion that what we're going to be seeing is a lot more of what Bud has described, and that this ultimately might be a program of integration into the society by the hybrids, and not necessarily by the aliens, but almost certainly by the hybrids. At least that's where the evidence seems to.
But they would be serving. It wouldn't be logical to presume they would be serving the aliens' purpose, whatever that might be.
Well, that, I certainly think it would, and yet even in some of the cases that I dealt with in Sight Unseen, they seem to be a little conflicted about the fact that their true connection and loyalties lie in with the gray aliens, and yet they seem to develop, at least in some cases, enormous sympathies and connections with normal humans. So they're a little bit conflicted about their loyalties, which means this whole thing is enormously complex emotionally, psychologically, and every other way. And incidentally, we're going to have a conference on October 11th, details can be found out on our website, which is intrudersfoundation.org.
Mm-hmm.
Intruders. But anyway, at that conference, one of the people coming is one of the people I've written about in the book, who is himself a university professor. But he is going to be talking about his encounters, which have been several, with what seems to be a hybrid being that he seems to have some connection with from time to time. It's a very, very bizarre story.
Hmm.
But as Dave said, some of these cases are extremely credible, and the descriptions they're giving are really fascinating.
Yes. But do you remember a story you told me about an abduction that occurred in New York City?
Oh, I've had many abductions that occur in New York City. That's where I happen to live.
Yes, but this came right out of a skyscraper or something. I mean, this person literally came out of a skyscraper.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've had, of course, the abduction case that was so important was the one that I wrote about and witnessed, where the woman floated out of a 12-story window.
That's right.
And up into a craft and was witnessed by numerous people.
Well, I wonder if either of you have thoughts on this. Yes, that was an incredible story, and everybody who talks about abductions says, well, how come they always occur, out in the middle of the desert somewhere? And the fact is, occasionally they occur in a place like New York City. What would you imagine could be so important, either one of you, so that they would take the chance of doing something in the middle of an urban area like New York?
Well, this goes right back to what Bud was talking about as one of the aspects of his book, and that is that location really doesn't mean anything. If you can't be seen, it doesn't matter where a person is abducted.
That's a good point.
What was extraordinary about the Linda case was that she was seen being abducted. There, people, all sorts of people on the outside watched her floating through the window. Now,
I think there was a car from the UN or something, wasn't there?
There were many people who were in a procession of cars.
Exactly.
Who were diplomatic people from different countries, even and UN personnel and so forth.
Yep.
And all of them, the cars were stopped, and almost as if this was a built-in audience. And the abduction only took place when the cars were all stopped, their engines killed, of the electrical system. And then at that point, the lights were turned on, and the show took place. The woman floated out as if the aliens were for the first time saying, look what we can do. But the main thing about this invisibility issue, as Dave just said, it doesn't make any difference. And I have to take my hat off to Dave, who was the first one to present the invisibility issue as a a given aspect of abductions. But I have had, I've looked into abductions that took place in Tokyo, in Chicago, in Rome, in Paris, in London. I mean, you cannot imagine. And I have abductions. I hear about an abduction and look into it in New York that occurs in New York City probably once a month at this point.
I get these little computer messages as I go, and Darren in Decatur, Illinois, says, hey, I think the sickly and irradiated grays are us, humans, from a future gone wrong, trying to fix a situation without ruining themselves, thus the hybrids. Time travel art, that's how the aliens got here. Possibility? Question mark?
Well, you know, I've looked at this, and I'm not a physicist, and I'm certainly not a time traveler, so I don't have a whole lot of experience in it, and I count on my fingers and my toes. But there is a certain logical fallacy with time travel, because if people were traveling through time back from time, mm-hmm. that means that the future has already happened, and that the future is predetermined to lead to those people traveling back in time. And if you come back and change the present in some way, you are changing it to conform to the future that has already been predetermined, which would therefore automatically and absolutely lead those people to come back for in time and try to change the present. And when you change the present, you're changing it in such a way that automatically determines that those people will in the future come back and change the present, and it goes on. It's a loop that you can't get out of.
However, if you, well, okay, we'll get off into a, that'll take us off into a time travel discussion, which I'd love to do. But, you know, a lot of things are going on Earth right now. The Antarctic is melting. The Arctic just cracked literally in half. The Ward Ice Shelf. I mean, things are going on Earth at a pretty rapid pace right now that might cause somebody to conclude that in the future, the next 100, 200 years, whatever, this could be a really different place. What do you think?
Well, as a historian, I'll tell you right off, you can't tell the future. But I'd say that what you just said, Art, was probably a pretty safe bet.
it certainly seems it. And whether if the aliens are interested in healing our planet, as many people say, they might be healing it for them as well as for us, or instead of for us. And, of course, one of the problems with the idea that that's their basic mission with the abduction phenomenon is that most abductees are not necessarily more environmentally conscious than most non-abductees.
Well, sticking with David's theory of how things might be, though, they also might be waiting for a vacancy. You follow me?
I've never been thought of.
I'm not sure what to make out of it. I don't know why, you know, if they saw that we were cascading toward extinction, you wouldn't think they'd be needing to do this abduction business and all this toying around with reproductive stuff.
Well, that's a good point, actually, and we might in fact be heading towards extinction, but it might be a million years from now, and so it doesn't really matter for their agenda. But the fact is, though, that what we're all doing together right now is dealing with the nature of alien intentions.
Yes,
and this is something that the abduction phenomenon has allowed us to do for the first time.
Right.
When we studied the outside shells of objects for years and years and years and years, any attempt to figure out exactly who was inside them and what they were doing here or what they wanted was just impossible.
Impossible. Just impossible. We've got sightings. We've got physical stuff. That bar is passed, too. They've been up there, and they've been up there for as long as we've been alive. And you're right. We can't conclude a damn thing from any of that. But these abductions, that's a different story.
That's right. Now, for the first time, you can have serious discussions about the nature and purposes of this phenomenon and who these beings are and just exactly what they want with us and why they're doing these things to us. And I think that this is a huge step forward in UFO research, one that I don't think that people fully understand. I think that a lot of people in UFO research feel that we're just sort of treading water, that we don't know any more now than we did 30 years ago, and there's no place else to go and all that. And yet at the same time, when you take a look at the abduction phenomenon, you realize that we've pretty much cracked this thing open, and we're dealing with the details of their intentions and the details of their program on a minute basis. And, you know, it's something that I think that more and more people have to realize. The evidence has been presented in almost an avalanche form, in the past 20 years especially. And now we're beginning to deal with it, I hope.
Okay, is there any such thing as a typical abduction? I mean, are there enough commonalities that you two hear with all the people you talk to say, here are the things in common, here is a typical type abduction?
Well, but I found all mine to be completely different. What about you?
the similarities are extraordinary. And now, this is a very interesting thing, way of looking at it. It's the things that the aliens do when they abduct people, the methods they use and so forth, and what happens when the person is on the table are extraordinarily similar, and in a negative way, when you turn it around, there are all these things that they never do. Now, as an example, when the abductee is put on a table, stripped, yes, put on a table, paralyzed, and we used to use the term examined, but we know actually that these are fixed procedures that they go through. They seem always extraordinarily interested in two aspects of the human body, the reproductive system, mm-hmm, and it would seem the central nervous system. Over and over again, those are the focuses of their interest in the human body. Now, when we go to a doctor, we worry about our heart and lungs and so forth.
Oh, yes.
We have no cases, virtually no cases, where there seems to be an interest on the alien's part in the human cardiovascular system. They never pay any attention to the heart. Now, this is really interesting because we do. This is something central to us, but it never turns up in UFO abduction accounts. And it certainly would be turning up that way if, in fact, this is a product of fantasy. It's not a product of fantasy. It's a product of a very rigid, repeated system that the UFO occupants are using when they deal with human beings.
All right, then what kind of inference can we draw from that?
Well, I think we can draw the inference that their interest in us is physical, and I should also say emotional, too, and psychological, and how our minds work. They are not interested in our technology. They don't care about our computers and our weaponry and so forth. They are interested in human beings' physical properties, their DNA, their particular genetic makeup. And they're interested in the way our minds work and our emotions operate and so forth. This is one reason why very often abductees, during an abduction, after the physical parts that take place, the abductee is shown imagery, virtual imagery, so to speak,
mm-hmm,
as if they're trying to check what our reactions are emotionally to various things that they can present to us. They seem extremely interested in the way the human mind works.
What kind of things are they shown? Typically,
Dave, you want to?
Well, what people see, both on a screen-like device or within their own sort of mind's eye,
yes,
are sometimes scenes of devastation and destruction. Sometimes scenes of armies fighting, bodies littering the ground, and so forth.
Oh.
Sometimes they're shown scenes of average everyday life. Sometimes they're shown scenes of verdant, beautiful wilderness areas. There's a variety of things that people see. Most people are more impressed, of course, by the violent scenes.
One of the interesting cases I have is a man who was, after he was examined and the physical procedures take place, he was allowed to walk in the craft independently, which is very, very rare, but does happen. And he was in some area which was quite dark, and he looked down at the floor. He saw something on the floor,
yes,
and there was a apparently dead or dying alien on the floor. And he looked down at it. He could see its face, and he felt this wave of sympathy for it, as a human might for any kind of a dying fellow creature of any sort.
Yes.
And as he was studying this, he realized off to one side there were three aliens standing, staring at him, observing him intently. as if they were reading his emotions and as if what he was seeing was actually something that was being staged.
As if they wanted to understand how we would react to the prospect of death.
Exactly. And their death, say, at this point. It's almost like a projective test where they elicit emotions from humans.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And they seem fascinated in the way our minds work. We have, Dave and I have had many, many, many cases of this where, and Dave has given the name staging, where these events seem to be staged. And they're little, almost little playlets sometimes, but they're shown things, the abductee, because it's almost a projective test. We think the aliens can pick up the emotions of the viewer, of the human viewer.
Well, I'm going to be pushing you to the edge of what you're able to comment on, but then again, the same question, then what is the inference we can draw from that? They want to know what our emotions are about something like death. Why? Toward what ultimate end?
Well, I tend to look at this just a little differently, and I think that Bud is right, but I think that it's more of a neurological checking, at least now, and I'm just guessing here, of course. I think that this is more of a neurological conditioning for future activity.
Well, one of the things that's interesting on this that I've written about in Sight Unseen are situations where they seem to be wanting to learn from us what our emotions and feelings are so that their hybrid beings, these hybrids, know how to behave and perform when they're on Earth.
Ha, ha, ha. All right, yes, got that. All right, listen, we're coming to the end of an hour here, Bud.
Okay.
Your call, if you want to stick around, we're happy to have you.
I think I've contributed what I have to contribute, and I really appreciate for the chance to have done it, too.
All right.
So thank you very much.
Thank you. Bud Hopkins, thank you. And David, hold tight. And all of you, hold tight. That was quite a bit to digest. Good evening, everybody. Dr. David Jacobs continues with us next. Stay right there. My guest is Dr. David Jacobs. I'm Art Bell. His book is UFOs and Abductions, Challenging the Borders of Knowledge. That's his most recent book that you're certainly going to want to look into. His original book, the one that I first had him on the program for, was called The Threat. Now, in that book, Dr. Jacobs describes an alien culture that perhaps... or a threat that you might be a ride. You know, doctor, I'm all the time getting these people call me up. Hey, Art, how do I get abducted? Oh, I want to be abducted. I want to see what it's like. I want to experience this. What do I do to get abducted? And I always write back and say, be careful what you wish for.
Right. Actually, the way that what you do to get yourself abducted is you have a mother or a father who's an abductee.
In other words, it's all in the family.
It's all in the family, right? It's intergenerational, and that's the one thing that all abductees have in common. But let me just make a little minor adjustment to what you just said, Art. My first book actually was called The UFO Controversy in America, and then years later, in 1992, I published Secret Life, which was about abductions, and I think it was on your show for that originally, and then
that
may Threat well be. Came out. And,
yeah, The Threat hit me right between the eyes. That's why I said that. It really hit me between the eyes.
I think it hits everybody right between the eyes, but not in the way that I would want.
Well,
it's a pretty strong book, and it goes pretty far out on a limb, and it's one of those books that I tell people I'm horribly embarrassed about.
Really?
And yet I'm extremely confident of the data.
You're highly embarrassed. Why embarrassed? I mean, there's plenty of people that are out on just as narrow a limb on the other side, you know, saying they're here to help us, they're going to save us from some ecological disaster, they're friendly, they're warm and fuzzy, all the rest of it. There's plenty of people out on that limb, so why be embarrassed to be out on this one?
Right, and it's, you know, that's why I'm writing this book that I've been doing now. At least I've been threatening to do it, but I'm about halfway through it now, which is about methodology. All this boils down to is learning how to learn about the subject. One of the things we've discovered is that when people remember what happened to them, mm-hmm. straight out,
yes.
And it's just a conscious memory without any hypnosis whatsoever,
right.
It's almost always totally wrong.
It's almost always totally wrong?
That is correct.
You mean as corrected later by hypnosis or what?
Right. What we find is that because this is a clandestine phenomenon, and because it's people's memories are blocked neurologically, obviously, there's no other way to do it. When they remember something straight out, they remember bits and pieces of things, and sometimes even those bits and pieces are distorted, and they put them together into a seamless narrative, and it becomes a concrete memory to them, and they stake their life on it. I mean, I've had people tell me, absolutely, with fist in palm, this is what happened to me. I remember it like it was yesterday, and this happened, this happened, this happened, and this happened. And then we'll investigate this case, you know, the situation, the memory in hypnosis, and they begin to realize it didn't happen that way. And they'll say, you know, I think I was wrong about this. This is not what I'm remembering. What I'm remembering now is something else, which actually suddenly becomes more logical, and they can see the pieces that they had remembered and how it fits into a more complex
story. Does it suddenly become darker when you do hypnosis? Do you find?
Yeah, sometimes no, sometimes yes, but for sure it becomes different. And the problem then is that when people stake everything on their conscious memories, they might be a little bit on thin ice, And I just advise people just to be real careful, because what you remember is one thing, but if we do, you know, with competent hypnosis, it might turn out not to be exactly as you remembered, and in fact, it might turn out to be a lot stranger, which it usually does.
Well, with the technological level that human beings have right now, we know enough about genetics to know where that science is going. So then if your model is that the people that are doing these abductions are far ahead of us in these sciences, which by extension they would be, then the things that they could do with bodily fluids and the other things that are taken, the reproductive organs that are studied, well, there's no limit, is there?
You know, that's exactly right. They can pretty much do any damn thing they want. But what, it also begs this bizarre question, and the question is, if they're taking people's sperm and taking people's eggs, which we've known about since Antonio Villas-Boas back in 1957, if they're doing that, then why don't they just, you know, take a couple thousand eggs from each woman, and they would, you know, and they'd need all the eggs that they would ever have. They would just take the follicles, and they could mature the eggs in vitro. And you know, once you get a couple of gallons of sperm around, you could make a whole lot of babies with a couple of gallons of sperm if you know how to do it right. Well, and so we don't know exactly, you know, why they're doing what they're doing. But one of the things that we found in this phenomenon is that everything is absolutely logical. They know exactly what they're doing, and they are doing it for a reason, and the way in which it is done is the best possible way for them.
All right, give me an example from any abduction case you care to call back to memory of something that follows a chain of logic. In what way? Describe it to me.
Well, you know, I'll go back to this call that Hopkins gave me back in 1983 when he told me this amazing story about how they had this woman saw this strange baby, and they had her put this baby up to the baby's breast. And this was one of my favorite stories, because at that time in 1983 or 84, whenever it was, I mean, this was, we were just beginning to learn about this subject, and we really didn't know much about it at all. And I remember thinking, this is just the strangest, most bizarre thing I ever heard in my life. And I said to Bud, I said, you know, did she tell them that when they told her to put the baby up to her breast and feed the baby, that this can't be done? She's not pregnant. She's not lactating. She just can't feed the baby. That's not how human beings work. And he said, well, yes, she did. She said that she couldn't feed the baby, but they forced her to put the baby up to her breast anyway.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, gosh, that is so bizarre that we will never, if this is true, we will never be able to communicate with these beings because they value form over function. The form is putting the baby up to the breast, and the function is feeding the baby, but there is no way to feed the baby. And therefore, their style of thinking is very, very different than ours.
Well, what do you conclude from that? I mean, is it symbology or?
No, it was nothing of the sort. It was just that we didn't know. What we learned later on is that there's a procedure that takes place on the table or early on in the abduction phenomenon, which stimulates lactation. And whether a woman knows it or not, she is, in fact, lactating, and the baby will feed.
Do you think for the simple traditional reason? I mean, humans have always thought that breastfeeding has all kinds of advantages for a child. A breastfed child has advantages over a non-breastfed child. Certain nutrients and protections against viruses and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. There's supposed to be advantages. We've certainly always thought that. Any reason to believe that it was any different with them, in quotes?
There probably isn't, actually, but you've come to that's also another can of worms question because, you know, how much are these babies fed? And the question is which ones are actually fed or not. And because, as Bill Hamilton mentioned and as I talked about in Secret Life and in The Threat, aliens do not ingest food through their mouth.
Uh-huh.
And late-stage hybrids, the ones who look really human, will ingest food through their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Early-stage hybrids, the ones who look primarily alien but somewhat human, don't. And so the question then is what kind of babies is she feeding, and how much milk do they actually need, and how do they get nutrients other than the milk, and is this woman who is feeding the baby the only woman who will feed that particular baby, or is there a succession of women who are feeding the baby? Is it
how frequently in abduction stories have you even run into that?
Oh, all the time.
All the time.
Oh, it's extremely common, an extremely
really?
Common phenomenon. Yeah, I can't emphasize that enough. This is an extremely common event.
Oh, brother. So, you know, do you think that these hybrids are for our benefit ultimately, or their benefit ultimately, or is there some common cause?
You know, I really wish that this was for our benefit. I want this to be for our benefit. I want this to lead to a better life, a better world, a better whatever, a happier
something.
But all I hear is how everything is going to be great in the future. Everything is going to be wonderful in the future when they are here with us.
Yes.
But I don't hear that it's going to be wonderful for us necessarily, and it's certainly going to be wonderful for them. They tend to talk almost exclusively from their perspective, and their perspective is very different than ours. So this program, which they've obviously invested a tremendous amount of energy and personnel into, is something that they think is extremely worthwhile and obviously positive for them. But when I look at the future with him, I'm filled with trepidation.
Is it your view, Doctor, that they feel the victims of abduction and maybe the mothers of the hybrids with what they feel, and then the mothers are simply translating this in their own brain into the joy over what's occurring, but it's not their joy, it's the aliens' joy.
Yeah, that's another really good question, and it leads to two areas. Number one, when you deal with aliens, gray aliens, their emotions are severely restricted, so joy is not something that we see in them. With late-stage hybrids who really look quite human, they do have joy. But the other question then is, why would a woman be feeling this kind of maternal joy to feed an infant and or hold an infant or have some sort of other skin-on-skin contact with an infant? And the answer is that that's a mixed bag. A lot of women say, ugh, I don't want to go near those babies. Get those babies away from me. Don't let those babies touch me, you know. Hmm. And they sort of force the woman to do this anyway. But some women do have these maternal feelings. Now, here is the situation when you take a step back from it. They're standing there naked on board a UFO, surrounded by bug-eyed monsters from another planet and weird-looking babies, and they're beginning to have overwhelming maternal feelings, and they want to hug and feed the babies and so forth. And the question is that the appropriate emotional response for the event?
You know, I'm not a mom, so I don't know.
Right, and the answer is I'm not one either, and so I can't tell, but I do know that they simply forget about their surroundings, and they have this kind of...
But that's not natural and normal, is it?
Well, it's not necessarily their own babies, either.
I'm sure that maternal instinct's very strong, David, but gee, in a spaceship naked with aliens, like you said, bug-eyed monsters standing there, that's got to be some really strong maternal instinct.
It's got to be off-putting, let's put it that way.
It would be for me.
Yes. So the point is that these, I think a lot of these feelings are simply generated in them neurologically.
Well, that's why I asked, with regard to this rosy future and things being better and this wonderful feeling that people describe, I talk to them, I hear it all the time. How can we be sure if they can impart one feeling, the strong maternal get over where you are and who's looking at you feeling, go ahead and feed that baby, that's pretty good, then why not impart the future's going to be wonderful, but, you know, it might not be our future that's wonderful, it might be theirs.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what a lot of people feel, that the future's going to be wonderful, but they're sort of confused about for who and for what and all that. But there's something else, and that is that there's another procedure here that I might as well just kind of strictly address, and that is an extremely effective procedure, both effective and affective. It accomplishes what it needs to do, and it has tremendous influence on people as well. That is to say that there's an egg-taking procedure, and virtually all women go through this at one time or another, even women, obviously, with hysterectomies and having people have their ovaries removed. Since they're abductees for all their lives, before that they've had these experiences. So they've all had it one way or another. And they take eggs in a specific way. It's usually intravaginally and all that. But in fact, they can stimulate sexual arousal. And we've heard this many, 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 many times, much to the abductees' embarrassment. And this goes all the way up to peak arousal, so to speak, to the peak moment.
To climax, yeah.
Right. Well, at which point, they go ahead and take the egg. And there's something that physiologically takes place that facilitates the egg taking. And I've seen this procedure literally hundreds of times, and that is not an exaggeration.
Well, and why is that unusual to contemplate? I mean, after all, normally all of this begins to take place with that thing we call sex, right?
And
so maybe there's some aspect of the actual act of sex that goes well in the way that a mother feeding a child goes well. I mean, some part of it that's important.
That's right. Yeah, it either facilitates it through the normal changes that take place, or else it facilitates release of eggs.
Plus, you'd have to admit it would take the edge off an abduction.
It does do that. and that's sort of what my point is here. Now, almost immediately, everything subsides, and they just go about their business. And there's nothing sexual about this. It's all just reproductive, with this kind of sexual arousal feelings that women feel and just is engendered in them, usually while one of these beings stares very deeply into their eyes. And if I might leap to more kind of strange things to say, by what they're doing is they're stimulating the optic nerve and then using the optic nerve as a conduit to stimulate other neurological sites in the brain, which would cause this. But the point is this. Now, supposing this happens to you when you're a 9-year-old girl, and it goes on and on, all through 9, all through 10, 11, 12, through adolescence and into adulthood, do you think this might affect someone? The answer is, for some people, no, but for other people, yes.
I'd have said yes.
Right. And And a lot of this kind of effect comes out in people saying, you know, I've known aliens all my life, and they're just wonderful, and I just love them, and they love
me. You're right. You're absolutely right. I've had more of those than I can tell you about, and they seem so totally far out, and I've had women on the program talking about, I swear to you, sex with aliens and real serious about it.
Right. Well, now there's another aspect to that as well, and as long as we can bring this conversation full circle by this part.
Sure.
And that is that, first of all, aliens have no genitals, so having sex with them is a tough one.
Yeah.
That's a tough one. But hybrids, late-stage hybrids, do. And late-stage hybrids are pretty much human. Now, the cycle of taking eggs and inserting fetuses and then taking out the fetuses, this goes on and on and on. But, you know, with an adult hybrid, you can do the same thing but bypassing a couple of procedures. You can go, what happens is, if I may backtrack a little bit, if you take an egg and a sperm and then you fertilize them, so you put them together, and then you take that gamete and you, or a zygote, and you in some way introduce alien DNA, let's, for the purpose of argument, say that that's what's happening, you know, I'm not exactly sure. Then you have to take that fertilized egg with the DNA in it and put it back into the female, you know, and 10 weeks later you remove it and then it's gestated in this kind
That's
of
right.
container, as Bud pointed out. With an adult hybrid, he is already inserting pre-DNA'd material, so to speak. In other words, you don't have to take the sperm and the egg and take them out and then, you know, and then alter it.
Because you've got the real McCoy right
there.
It's
already altered. And so we do see that between adult hybrids and women and men. And
just to even imagine this. All right, hold on. We're at a break point. Dr. David Jacobs is my guest. And what we're talking about is abduction. And maybe we're talking about a lot more than that. Are we talking about a new world? Are we talking about a change in human beings forever and ever? I wonder. Guarantee you one thing, you'll never hear a discussion of this sort on the major networks, at least until some of those hybrids begin to get to be made network vice presidents or something. David, I've got a sort of a little fast blast I want to read here from Kay in Birmingham, Alabama, who says, Art, you know, the first place I'd look for any answers would be hybrids. From history, the past history, the answer I keep coming back to is the account of the fallen angels recorded in the Bible, compelling evidence, in my opinion. The reason is a case of good versus evil. Well, you know, inevitably, David, we're going to get to people with the Bible and God, and when you start talking about aliens and reproduction and manipulating human beings and hybrids, and that's creation, David, of a kind. It's like creation, and you know, people are threatened because of their religious beliefs.
Right, and the major religions are big enough to incorporate these kinds of events into them somewhere along the line. And but actually, there's a way of looking at this that's a little bit different. And one of the ways of doing it is to ask the question: is how long have abductions been going on?
How long have they been going on?
Well, if this is intergenerational, what that means is that if a non-abductee, you know, marries an abductee, mm-hmm. then and they have four children, all four children will be abductees from what we've been able to tell, at least close to it. And so it's not normal genetics. It's sort of abnormal genetics. It's not like, you know, two will be and two won't be and all that sort of luck of the draw.
We have to do the numbers on that one. It's kind of like putting a penny away and then doubling it every day. I forget what it is, but in 45 days or something, you're a millionaire.
You're right. It, that's That's exactly it.
Well, aren't we creating hybrids at that kind of accelerated rate?
Well, I'm not sure. We might indeed be, but in terms of how old this situation is, then the question then is how long will it take for everybody to be an abductee?
Exactly. In other words, that's what I meant when I said the entire human race may be undergoing a change. You know?
Right. But I don't think that's the case. I think that only a small percentage of humans are abductees. I think it's probably around 5%, maybe a percent more or less.
Huh.
But certainly within that ballpark. I don't think it hits double digits yet.
All right. Before we leave entirely the sexual aspect of this, if this phenomena cuts across every class,
right.
Then do we have, and I know we keep records, a ratio of heterosexual to homosexual abduction experiences?
Well, it mirrors the society. It's just exactly the same.
It does.
It mirrors the society. Now, one would assume that it wouldn't because people who are gay oftentimes don't have biological children, although oftentimes they do. So there would be a slowing down in that area.
Although they would be every bit as physically able, physiologically able, as we would.
They would, but they wouldn't necessarily get married to an opposite sex.
Obviously.
But I think that it mirrors the society. I think that the phenomenon is so large that it mirrors just virtually everything pretty much in the numbers that we ought to see ethnically and religiously and in terms of sexual preference and all that. But here's the point I'm saying. If this phenomenon started back in biblical times, then by the year, 300 A.D. or so, or 200 A.D., everybody would have been an abductee.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody would be thereafter. And if it started in the year 1100, well, by the year 1300 or so, everybody would be an abductee. And if it started in the year 1400, by the 17th century, everybody would be an abductee. It takes about 7 or 8 generations for this to happen. And we know that only a small percentage of the people are abductees. So when we trace the numbers back that way, it seems to start around the 1880s, 1890s.
Okay, that means it's pretty well a lot far along then by now, right?
There has been a lot of water under the bridge.
A lot of water under the bridge.
And even though it's only been a little over 100 years.
A lot of broken waters under the bridge.
Right. And there's been there's already several generations that have passed by, and what you see is a growing number of people who are abductees, and it shows up in our statistics as well, in the polls that we've taken, and that we have a growing number of people between the ages of 18 and 25, I guess it is, or who've had unusual experiences than people over the age of, let's say 55 to 70. And of course that shouldn't be, because when you ask people if you have these sort of strange experiences, which we've asked them, people who are 18 or 20 years old haven't lived long enough to be able to say yes to a variety of them, whereas people who are 50 or 60 have, and they've had more opportunity because they've lived longer to have had these kinds of strange experiences. But in fact, younger people are saying that this has happened to them in greater frequency than older people. And I think that's that cone-like effect that you see spreading out in the society because of the intergenerational aspect of it.
Are we able to note anything at all about the way the hybrids operate, what they do, the way they live their lives, anything that it would suggest to us function?
Well, yes, there is what we see here. I must say we don't know a whole lot about hybrid and hybrid life, but we know much more about hybrids than we do about aliens.
There you are.
And but still, it's obviously very sketchy. But we see I've seen hybrids in group situations where one woman described them sort of and they were how they slept at night and their grooming kind of procedures for themselves and getting dressed and all that. But where we've seen hybrids more than anything is in abduction activity. And in recent years, and I think I might have mentioned this to you before, Art, but it's still true. In recent years, we've seen more and more hybrid-directed abductions with less and less aliens present. And this is what I think is a fairly ominous business. I don't like this. I want to bring back the aliens. They're my friends. I like them.
Suppose somebody were to conclude, Doctor, that what's going on now with the abductions is just perhaps modifying or righting some wrong with regard to the original creation?
Well, it's possible. You know, if we could get into their minds more with that, it might be true. Maybe they're just genetically changing us to become, you know, more like them in some way so that we would be more perfect in their eyes. This is all their agenda. Once again, it's not ours. What I think is happening, which is also disturbing to me, is that if this, in fact, is an integration program, the point is that these beings have abilities and skills that we do not have. And they have abilities to do things with their minds and with their technology that we just can't do. And that automatically makes us into second-class citizens. And there's a built-in inequality that I don't look forward to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just integrating into the society. It's integrating into the society on their terms. And when Bud Hopkins was and I were talking, we were sort of talking about how they're physically interested in people and they do this procedure and that procedure and some of the things they don't do. And one of the interesting things that I found over the years is that they appear to have no interest whatsoever in anything that is political or economic or social. Or religious or anything like that. There's nothing, no interest in human institutions, no interest in how humans lead their lives on an intellectual level.
That's fascinating. So if they have no interest in any of that, what do they have an interest in?
Well, if they have no interest in any of that, that suggests to me that if this is an integration program, they will be integrating with their own institutions.
So in other words, it suggests to you our institutions, whenever everything is finally their way, whatever their way is, it's not going to include any of our current institutions because they don't give a rat's, they don't care.
It seems that way from what I can extrapolate, and I may be wrong about this, but their total lack of interest suggests that that they have their own way of living that we will have to abide by, and human institutions will simply become secondary or unimportant or
I sure hope people are listening very carefully to what you're saying, because the traditional view is they're here to help us, they're benign, they're wonderful, the future's going to be great. Listen very carefully, folks, to what Dr. Jacobs is saying. They don't care about our institutions. They don't care about politics. They don't care about our social lives. So think about that. What does that mean? Exactly what he just said, that probably that won't be part of, well, our future when we get there, and we must be well on our way. Do you see, let's presume for a second all of this is correct, Doctor, and they are not our friends, and they're about to change everything we know, and, well, I don't know if we love politics, you know, but everything we sort of, our way of being, that all that is going to change. Is there any way to stop it?
This is an area where not enough talented people have thought about and put their minds together and try to figure out a way to stop it. Now the problem is this, that this is a global phenomenon, and the amount of people who are being abducted around the world is just fantastic.
What's our best guess? What do we think?
Well, if it's 5% of the American population, it's almost certainly 5% of the world population, and 5% of 6 billion is
what,
about 300 million,
yeah,
and growing.
And that would be about the size of the population of the U.S.
Yeah, now supposing that I'm wrong by a factor of, 50% or so, and you're still dealing with tremendous numbers of people. And as I said, growing all the time, which means that they have invested a tremendous amount of energy and resources into this phenomenon. So this is a very, very, very important event for them, and certainly, obviously, for us. And the abduction phenomenon continues night and day, day after day, year after year. And and doesn't seem to be abated. And Art, I've already forgotten the first part of your question.
Do you think our military is aware of this ongoing process?
Well, you know, as we talked about some time ago, I hope they are. I really hope they are, and I hope the government is aware of it, and I hope that they're all working on it.
Because if our entire way of life and thinking and living is threatened, you know, everything we know and love, if all of that is threatened, then that would be a very serious threat against us, hence the military would be certainly looking into it.
But there's another more subtle side, Art, and the subtle side is it's completely crazy. And that's the side that they all go for, and in their minds, you know, that's the right side. And when you take a look at this from the outside, it certainly seems like the right side. What I've been saying for the past hour is to any, you know, logical person who doesn't know anything about the subject is completely insane, and I'm exquisitely aware of that. But I do think that the government takes its cues primarily from the scientific community, and I can absolutely guarantee you that the scientific community is resolutely hostile to this subject. It doesn't take a neutral stance. It doesn't take a stance of, oh, that's interesting, let's learn more about it. It takes a stance of, this is just completely nuts, and we will not look at it or study it ever.
Well, certainly publicly, you're correct. That stance they take. I wonder, though, you know, there's so many levels of government and secrecy that we don't know about. And
that's true.
Maybe at some level they don't laugh so hard. Maybe at some level they really are studying this and concerned about it and trying to figure out how to fight it.
Well, all I can say is I just hope that that's the case. I really hope that that's the case because somebody's got to be doing it. I mean, it's not up to Bud Hopkins and me and a few other people around the country who do this. Somebody else has got to be doing this too, and I hope you're right.
Well, if somebody comes to you, doctor, and they say, "Look, I've been getting abducted since I was 9. I'm fed up with it. I hate it. For whatever reason, I want it to stop. Can you help me?" What would you tell them?
Well, if they lived in the area that I live in the Philadelphia or East Coast area, and they could get to me, I would have them fill out a questionnaire first, and I would have them, and I would decide whether or not they were, you know, compatible to going forward with me and all that, and whether they had some mental illness or something.
Yeah, but my larger question is, I guess, is there a way to stop abduction?
And then I would tell them that what we'll work for is emotional and intellectual control of this situation, so you can get under control, you can know what's going on, you can know how it's affected your life, and eventually get to the point of stopping thinking about it, stopping obsessing on it, and just go on and lead a normal life. But physical control I cannot give them. I can't stop this phenomenon from happening. And the problem is this, and now I remember my train of thought, the phenomenon is so large, and yet it is clandestine. And most people, maybe 99% of abductees, do not know that they're abductees. So you can't stop it on a worldwide basis. You don't even know where to stop it, starting at.
Can
you
stop it on the individual basis?
Right? And even then, it becomes tremendously difficult because it can happen at any time, night or day. Now, it usually doesn't happen during a work situation or when a person is in the company of a lot of people. But there are ways of stopping it. Yes, if you really want to, you can. I had one woman who took a length of string and she strung it up around her before she went to bed, even before she put her nightgown on.
Yeah.
And she strung it up around her crotch and up around her shoulders and around the other shoulder and down around and around her waist. And then she cut it off and she tied it up. And then she did it again with another length of string. And then she did it again, and then she did it again, and then she did it again.
Huh.
And so that she was completely trussed up, and then she told her husband to hide the scissors.
Oh, really?
Yes, and that stopped it. That stopped it. That was a zero abduction event. But it aborted it is what it did, because when she began to be abducted, they realized what she had done, and they refused to take her. And we know that they will not take people with these kinds of situations. And I won't go into it, but you've got to be sort of normal.
Well, so they took one look at her and they said, "We're out of here."
They asked her why she was doing that, and they told her this was not good. She shouldn't do this. And they told her not to do it. And first they wanted her to remove the string, and she said she couldn't. And then they told her this was very bad and she shouldn't do this. And they came back the next night and she had trussed herself up again. And they once again gave her this stern, you know, talking to about how this was bad. And she did it again the third night. And on the third night, she bargained with them and she said, listen, I will not do this anymore if, number one, you allow me to remember more than what I'm remembering.
Yes.
And if you block the fear, because I'm scared to death every time this happens, and if you make me less fearful. And they said, okay, we will do that.
Really?
Yes. And then she removed it. And then when she was abducted again, all she remembered was she was scared to death and she doesn't remember anything else.
Oh my! So she was actually able to effect an apparent concession from her.
Well, the concession was that she would stop doing it, and then they didn't live up to their bargain, and that was. But you see, the problem is that you can't live your life like that. You can't do this every night. She's got a life to live, and there's other ways where people have found where they can kind of stop it a little bit. But they all intrude so much on a person's life that your life effectively stops. But it gives us hope that on an individual basis, this might be stopped in other ways, which is why I say what we need is people who can think seriously about this subject.
Okay, we're barely into it. We've got one more hour. Are you good to go?
Well, I don't know about another hour, Art. It's 4 o'clock in the morning here.
How about another half hour?
Well, okay, half an hour.
We're trying to finish. All right, done deal, half an hour. Dr. David Jacobs is my guest. We're talking about abductions. Dr. David Jacobs, straight out, if this is what you seem to suggest it is on their part, and all of this will unfold not in our favor, then shouldn't somebody like yourself be screaming at the top of their lungs that this should be investigated, that there should be, if there isn't now, military action taken or whatever it would take, because in essence, we're being invaded. I mean, that's the right word, isn't it?
Well, I think it is the right word. I think we are involved with an invasion. It's not an occupation yet, but it is an invasion. And
well, it's the most subtle kind of ultimate occupation, though, isn't it?
Right. It's like... Well, I don't know if it's an occupation quite yet. I mean, they're here, they're doing their thing, but they're not necessarily giving orders and issuing curfews and that sort of thing, you know. But
not now.
Not yet. That's right. But you know, I don't really know how this thing's going to be played out, and maybe it won't be like that, and maybe it will be quite good and all that, but. But it does make me very, very uneasy, and I am filled with anxiety over it. And I never used to be. I used to think this was the most wonderful thing that had ever happened. I used to just be thrilled at the idea of dealing with UFOs. And you know, I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the subject when I was in graduate school. And
how did that go over?
I did it on the controversy over UFOs and didn't address the issue of whether UFOs existed or not, although I kind of assumed that they did in the subtext of this book, which made it different than all other books. So I assumed the legitimacy of the subject. But I didn't try to, you know, decide whether it was real or it wasn't real. I just did how the government dealt with it.
Well, even at that, how was it received?
There was a certain amount of resistance to my writing it originally, and then once I finally got it cleared by my major professor, it was okay, because it would be only the second dissertation ever published on the subject, and, ever written on the subject. Although Mike Schutz in sociology at Northwestern came about with one just a very short time later. But, now I think there's like 15 or 17 dissertations published on the subject in some way or another, but almost all of them are fairly negative. They all, you know, think that it's just sociological or psychological, or they go to the substratas of UFO research and dig down into the soft underbelly of the flying saucer world, you know, and write sociological treatises about the gullibility of people and all.
What about the International Center for Abduction Research?
Well, that is a title of an organization that has more words in it than there actually are members.
Really?
Right.
I would think, though, that the name would imply that they'd be objectively looking at abductions and taking care of those who have experienced them, that sort of thing.
The problem is this. Everything boils down to financing. I know that the Center for UFO Studies has had trouble in recent years with money, and the Mutual UFO Organization has, and membership has been falling off, and people, I think, have become saturated perhaps a little bit with the subject. And what we need is really a huge infusion of money and a large number of people to study this. And the people follow the money. If we could in some way get a benefactor or the National Institute of Health or National Science Foundation, whatever it is, to begin to give money in the millions as they do for other public health phenomena, then suddenly you're going to get a lot of interest in the subject by a lot of people in the scientific community, regardless of the...
What do you think might come of such a large-scale investigation? What do you think, what kind of conclusions do you think they might come to?
That is an excellent question. There's no doubt that they can come to the conclusions that I and Bud Hopkins and others have come to, that this is real, it's actually happening.
Yes.
That this has been going on for a long time, and that the first manifestations of it that were probably the airship wave of 1896 and the Foo Fighters of the 1940s, you know, and the Ghost Rockets of 46 and then the UFOs after that, and it's all part of the same program. But the ultimate question is, what can you do about it? That's still the ultimate question. And for the life of me, I cannot figure out a way to do anything about it. I keep thinking maybe there might have been a way back in 1947 if people had ever taken the subject more seriously than they did then, you know. But now this program is so far advanced, and these people are so advanced technologically and all that, I really am at a loss as to try to figure out even a strategy for dealing with it, let alone putting something into effect. I just don't know. I really don't know. We need help. Bud and I and others are just not enough. We need serious people thinking seriously about all aspects of this subject.
And money is the way we, I suppose, get there, right?
Unfortunately, in this society, pure interest means destruction of career.
And at the university level, indeed, destruction of career and possible loss of tenure and...
Everything comes crashing down. It's not good.
If it's set up that well, so that people at the university level, for example, can't do this without threat to their life or career, livelihood, well, then they've got us but good, don't they?
Right. It's not going to happen unless there's money involved. With money involved, when a person gets a grant to a university, the university takes part of that money and uses it for, quote, overhead. And they use it to help pay the person's salary, and it relieves the money pressure on a lot of different levels on the university. So everybody wants grants, and it makes them look good, and it makes the universities look good. And even a subject like this with enough money will look good, and suddenly the ridicule over it would stop, and all, you know, all the negative aspects of it in terms of the societal, the way the society of academics treats it, would stop once the money is there. Yeah, I don't want to be cynical about this, but I've been in academics virtually all my life, and that's the way it works.
So you can be cynical if you want to. That's fine. The invasion word is a very strong word, but when I consider everything Bud said and what he said over the years, and same with you, you know, that's what it adds up to. I mean, ultimately, if what you're saying is so, it's a done deal. It's just over with, and we didn't even notice.
You know, you're right. You might be right, Art. I wish I could say to you, oh, no, 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 it's not a done deal. Oh, no, there's plenty we can do. You know, but you might be right. There really may not be much we can do. Maybe I'm just despairing too much. Maybe I'm just, you know, feeling too frustrated or something. But maybe I'm just not smart enough to figure out what can be done, which is certainly more than likely.
Well, you're smart enough to consider at least what others seem to refuse to wish to consider, either because of societal pressure or because, I don't know, because somehow it's all a done deal and we laugh at these things and we don't pay attention when people tell stories. And We don't even pay attention when we seemingly have proof. We just don't pay attention at all. So if it's what you say it is, it's going to be a done deal, and there's not going to be a thing we can do about it.
Yeah, you know, I've fantasized about what's going to happen in the future and how one of these days I'm going to be proven right and all the rest of that stuff. And but what I actually think is that if I'm ever proven right, nobody's going to care who said it first. They're going to think of only one thing, run.
That's right. Well, that's absolutely right. I hope you're wrong, but I've always had, since I talked to you the very first time, I had this nagging, terrible feeling that you were right. And again, that goes back to the question I asked at the beginning of the half hour. If you really feel you're right, and I can sense you feel that way, even if you're not willing to get out there as strongly as I am, then what about this screaming from the top of the lungs thing?
Right, and the question then is, I can scream from the top of my lungs and everybody will think I'm crazy and all the rest of that stuff. Of course, they think I'm crazy anyway, but in the end, the question then is, so what? So if I do scream and people do take cognizance of it and all that, you know, is it too late? Has too much happened? Does it really even matter anymore?
Well, there's the question for you. Let's address that. It's a little more narrow, but it's an interesting question. You laid down some timelines for us, how frequently it's happening, the way it multiplies, and the number of years that you think it's been going on. Based on all of that, is it too late?
Well, to tell you the truth, I think it is, and it's the reason is I think it's too well. You know, I don't know. Let's put it this way: I really don't know, and I tend to think of, you know, in absolute sometimes, but I really don't know. However, it's not just that it's that we're late getting started. It's that the program is already well established, and we are dealing with a very advanced technology. And we are dealing with a very advanced physiological being, as opposed to just, you know, beings who figured out better physics.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because another person fast blasted. Look, Art, as these hybrids get older, as they mature, some of them are going to get ill. Some of them, for various reasons, are going to go to a doctor. Aren't doctors going to begin to notice a physical change that they can't explain?
Well, that would happen if they're here on a fairly large scale, and I don't think that anybody would say that quite yet. The most of the time when I've seen hybrids in my own research, it's been as Bud has indicated a little bit, although he has other cases that indicate differently, but it's been primarily to abduct people, and I've had fairly complex hybrid activity here, but still surrounding the abduction of a person, taking a person from her car, having her follow them, taking them to an abandoned base outside of a military base, for example, outside of Washington D.C.
Yes,
and with another hybrid and taking a couple of people and abducting them there and so forth. And I've had these things, and I've had more complex events happen with hybrids as well. But I have yet to have a case. I have yet to have more than one case. Let's put it this way, of a person who is obviously living here and working here. But we should have, if that were the case, we should have like many, 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 many of these cases already, and they're still relatively rare enough so that I don't run across them so much. Although Bud might. But that's still a rare event. So.
I wonder if there's any kind of difference or development in the medical community that's been observed but not necessarily reported on or anything like that.
Right, and that's an excellent question. And what you're dealing with here primarily is doctors who see anomalies in patients that they have never seen before.
Uh-huh.
If I had a nickel for every time I heard the phrase, you know, I've never seen like this before. It's the first time I've ever seen this, that they told an abductee, I could have retired from Temple years ago. But the fact is, though, that they don't take it in context. All they know is they're looking at the strangest kind of scarring, for example, or a scar pattern
yes.
that exists on both shoulders of a man in a certain kind of circular pattern with dots forming a design on both sides of his shoulders.
But trained very carefully to think in a certain way, they would dismiss any oddity of the pattern. They wouldn't be concerned with that. They'd be concerned with patching it up. I mean,
they're patching it up, but they'd also be concerned with, look at this. This is the weirdest thing. I've never seen anything like this. And they might even call in some associates to take a look at it, and it's just the weirdest thing. But what they don't know is that other doctors have seen the same thing.
Mm.
And have not written it up, and so they're unaware that what they're looking at, in fact, is a pattern of scarring, or a pattern of, and just sort of fill in the blank here, you know, for what abductees present with, but a pattern of this kind of anomaly that other doctors are seeing too, and they don't realize it's a pattern; they just think it's unique. Mm. That's what we see in physicians, for example, anomalous. Ovarian scarring, which is very common with abductees, because sometimes they'll use instruments to go directly into the ovary and take out follicles, and this causes scarring, and it can lead to sterility, because one of the ovaries might be too encrusted with scar tissue to release an egg, and this causes obviously awful problems in a person's life, and doctors will say, you know, I've never seen scarring like this before. It's just amazing.
David,
not knowing that many other doctors have all seen the same scarring and also done the same thing.
Another thing with medical professionals, they know, and so do police departments, that rapes are incredibly underreported. More of them occur than they even hear about. I refer now to the police, for example, medical professionals. People just don't report rapes. Do you think that abductions probably fall into the same category, that an awful lot of time somebody is either going to doubt their own sanity or their social pressure is going to keep them from reporting it, that they're incredibly underreported?
Absolutely. And people learn in grammar school to keep their mouths shut. Because if they open their mouth
That's
and they
true.
Say, well, these little people have been coming into my room and taking me out to their spaceship and so forth,
huh.
The teasing starts and it never stops. And they become ostracized from their friends, and they learn early on, this is something you just don't talk about. And they just prefer to put it in the back of their minds and not even think about it. And I've had many, many, many people who have been through this route.
Then when we're looking at the number of adoption... abductions that are occurring, how do we factor that in and come up with a number that might be so?
Well, when Bud and I did our Roper poll back in 1991, we asked a random sampling of people around the country a series of questions that abductees answered yes to in very high frequency and non-abductees answered no to in very high frequency. And so we just did random sampling of 6,000 people, 2,000-person sweeps. The poll was then repeated in 1998, I guess it was, by the Bigelow Organization.
Yes.
And the numbers were slightly different, but it still showed that there was one hell of a lot of people who had very, very strange experiences out there.
Do you remember the percentage?
Well, Bud and I, we did not ask the question, have you ever been abducted? Because that question people will say no to automatically, because what they've done is they've taken odd things that have happened in their lives and they've slotted them into seeing religious figures or traveling on the astral plane.
Oh, yes,
and
yes,
stuff
yes,
like that.
Sure.
So, but we know that people who are not abductees say no to these questions in very high frequency, and people who are say yes a lot. So we were able to extrapolate that you know, a fairly high percentage of the people out there, maybe 6-7%, maybe even more, were saying yes to these, but we cooked the figures to get them down to 2% because we figured that politically going forward in the media.
You're kidding.
With 5 or 6% was crazy.
You're kidding. You actually had to cook the figures the other way because they were much higher than you thought.
That is exactly
That's
right. I talked a little bit about this in the thread where we broke the poll in half. We decided we were only going to accept yes answers to what we call higher indicator questions, which were sort of higher indicator, but not quite. And then we refused to accept any people who had answered less than four or all five of the questions positively, and
that's
you could have
incredible.
Answered 8 out of the 10 questions positively in that poll and not made it to the final statistics.
Doctor, our time is up. Your book, UFOs and Abductions, Challenging the Borders of Knowledge, sounds like some book that somebody ought to run right out and get if they want to know more about what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
I thank you for being here.
Thanks, Art. I appreciate it.
You have a good rest of the day, Doctor.
I'll try.
Take care. Dr. David Jacobs.